I learned in my first summer internship in Newfoundland back in, back in Newfoundland in 1985, that if you are going to share any family stories, always let the congregation know you've talked to your family about it first. And I have spoken with Tevis about this. I think we're good. Preparing the Spencer home for Christmas has long been deliciously excessive because we are big Christmas people. In fact, I come from a good line of Christmas enthusiasts. My earliest memories being replete with full of rich Yuletide celebration, and that continued after Tevis and I were married. We both heartily embrace the season, enjoying the decorating, gift-giving, being with family and friends, and all the accompanying consumption of fine food and beverages. When we were first married, now a brief 37 years ago, we did up Christmas fairly heartily even then. But that festivity was tempered by the fact that we were both at university and living in fairly, shall we say, compact accommodation, space-wise. But we made up for that after we finished school, what with Tevis becoming a prosperous teacher and I being an affluent clergy creature. Now living in our own spacious home, we were now able to indulge in revelries with even greater abandon and excess. Our philosophy for the season has pretty much been, if you're going to have eggnog, then why not go the whole nog? Why not have chocolate eggnog with extra cream, and why some sprinkles too? Over time, it got more and more elaborate. Hence, putting up decorations became an increasingly complex operation because it wasn't just adding. No, this also required subtracting. You see, the pictures, vases, photographs, the knickknacks that usually populate Chateau Spencer, they all need to get stored away to accommodate the increasingly large array of Christmas things that we've accumulated over the years. And the way storage works in our home, as some of you already know, it means that I have to descend into the bowels of the crawl space under our house to not only extract the appropriate items for the holiday, but also to temporarily store the regular non-Christmas material that has been displaced. Hence the sheer volume of stuff and my aging body make this elements of the task of Christmasizing the house, well, just a little more challenging every year. This whole process has required some very careful thought, and there's been something of a learning curve in how to Christmasize the house. In fact, it's been a 37-year-long learning curve. But this year, I think we finally got it figured out. Instead of trying to do it all at once, we started early, and we worked gradually and incrementally. Sometime in mid to late November, I rummaged through the Christmas stash downstairs and took an afternoon to put up all the exterior Christmas lights that I had retrieved. And no, it's not quite the Griswold's light show, but we have a number. And I got them in place without accident or stress. And just to be clear, the lights were up, but they were not lit before the appropriate day because some traditions have to be scrupulously observed. Unless your neighbor says, could you turn them on early like he did this year? So, anyway, a week or so later, I went back to the crawl space and brought up all the bins of Christmas stuff and put them in the guest bedroom, which allowed Tevis to sort through them at her leisure. And over the week that followed, she puttered and I began to notice the distinct Christmas-tide atmosphere creeping into the place. At the end of the week, we bought a tree. Yes, we went out on a grueling and risky expedition and harvested at the Qualicum Foods Forest. And that evening, we put up the tree. Everything got decorated, and I stored the extra stuff away. All done, no one lost an eye, and it was all quite enjoyable. As you might imagine, one of the key features of this process in our house is setting up the manger scene. We have a few available to us. We have a cool rubber duck variety that sometimes lurks in one of our bathrooms. Really. But the main one is the more traditional plaster version that we typically have on the hearth in the living room. As I mentioned here on Christmas Eve a full decade ago, and I went back this last week to check. Yes, it was a decade ago. But there was a year that we couldn't find the plaster baby Jesus in our storage, and we found ourselves searching frantically, quite aware of the irony that, in fact, we'd somehow lost Jesus in our Christmas presentation. It's not a good look on someone who does what I do. But surprising no one, I somehow turned that into a sermon that year. Anyway, I'm happy to report back that we eventually found him. He's a little worn and a bit chipped. But somehow a damaged Jesus seems to possess some theological weight. Some significance that makes it just a bit more fitting, I think. Like the inevitable imperfection of a Christmas pageant, somehow I find it tells a story more richly than an unblemished one. Anyway, he and Mary and Joseph are back in their rightful places in front of us on the hearth right next to the tree. But even by spreading this whole process out, it's a lot of work, all that preparation, and I can see why people scale it back as energy decreases or the need to be elsewhere over the holiday changes the whole decorating dynamic. For a while, I was wondering if it would be simpler just to leave all the paraphernalia up all year round. I mean, how would that work? It could be an interesting experiment, don't you think? An old friend of mine tells the story of going to visit another buddy of his at his apartment. It was mid-August, and he wandered into the living room and couldn't help but notice that his Christmas tree was still standing. Tinsel and ornaments all still in place. Needles lying where they'd fallen on the floor beneath in August. And since you ask, no, he isn't married. And, and I say prospects are slim. In fact, it makes me think that the year-round Christmas tree experiment would probably require an artificial tree. But if you did keep the decorations up and the lights on outside, I wonder how that would work. Would you start getting tired of that pine smell? Would you stop seeing the decorations? Because I'm guessing the bloom would be off that rose fairly quickly. There's something about the fleeting nature of the season. Even if it unofficially seems to begin at 12 noon on Remembrance Day in this particular locale. We get a good 2 months of Advent and Christmas here. But there's still something but only having it for a relatively short time that adds to its magic. But despite that charm, there's also something about all the preparation and rearrangement that upsets the order of things. There's something about getting back to normal, back to the ordinary. It's a bit of a relief. Honestly, Jesus' arrival seriously disrupts our house. And all this stuff we do, it can seem a long way from that story from Luke's gospel that describes the birth of Jesus. You had the Roman census under the reign of Caesar Augustus and the trip to from the town of Nazareth to Bethlehem, all for the privilege of being taxed. Pregnant Mary making the trip, the birth, the cradle being an animal's feeding trough, the first recipients of the good news of Jesus' birth being shepherds of all people, just regular folks, no one special. The angels singing, the angelic message announcing the Messiah's birth, the shepherds' visit, and they're telling everyone they met about this strange event. And of course, the lines that I so love, with Mary pondering all this in her heart. Mary, what did you know? There's a bit of distance from there to trees and lights and eggnog, I find. Here's a question. Have you ever found yourself invited to a party where you really didn't know anyone beyond the person who invited you? That happened to Tev and me last summer. We were visiting our friends in Aubagne in Provence and in the southwest of France, and they held a party on Bastille Day, the Fête Nationale, July 14th. And they invited some family, none of whom we'd met before. Now, add that to Phil's limited French language skills. Well, it made for an interesting evening. But it worked out fine. They were a most welcoming and hospitable group. And we had lots of fun, and even with the limitations on our communication. Over the years, I've attended a goodly number of parties where I didn't really know too many of the attendees. And even for an extrovert like me, that can be a little intimidating. You ever had that experience? Been invited to the birthday of someone you don't really know that well, or don't even know at all? I admit we go a little overboard, but we're kind of fond of Jesus in our house. And it is his birthday and everything. Still, there are times when I'm suddenly struck by the fact that I don't know him as well as I think I do or as well as I'd like. I still remember the day when our daughter Ailish was born and then bringing her home from the hospital. We were so delighted. We were fascinated by this strange, alien little creature who, despite having just met her, we would without question have died for. Whom we loved with a fierce passion and who we were in awe of and who frankly made us a little afraid. I remember how her presence threw our lives into an uproar. Both Tevis and I had the experience with infants in our work in hospital. But at the end of your shift, you get to go home and responsibility's done, right? But this was rather different. I'm still not over the arrival of either of our children, truth be told, and they're 32 and 25 now. But there's something especially disruptive about babies. You notice that? They're inherently inconvenient and demanding. Coincidentally, there are also times when I find that Jesus to be rather disruptive, inconvenient, and even at times a bit demanding. Like babies, he's not really for the faint-hearted. Like a baby, he's delightful and awesome and endlessly fascinating and someone who makes me at times a little afraid. Some years back, I found a statement that captured a little of this complicated relationship that we experience in celebrating this baby's birth. It's presented to be read in parts. I think you're the bold print in the congregation. And it points to some of these complexities in that relationship, a relationship that calls us deeper and deeper, calls us to places we might not go otherwise if it weren't for him. And maybe you don't know this baby, this man, this Savior, this God with us, whose birthday we're about to celebrate. And maybe these aren't even your words yet, or maybe ever. Fair enough. But then again, it's kind of neat that you're all here tonight. And you are here. And in some way, somehow, you've thus been invited to his birthday to look at this baby. And perhaps in these words, you might glimpse his ordinary glory. Perhaps even might begin to know him. As the hymn writer said, come. Let us adore him. As you feel comfortable, please join me in this Christmas creed. I'm italics. I believe in Jesus Christ and in the beauty of the gospel begun in Bethlehem. I believe in the one for whom the crowded inn could find no room, and I confess that my heart still sometimes wants to exclude Christ from my life today. I believe in the one who proclaimed the love of God to be invincible.
Who loved her persons and came to receive what God has also done. Who are
I confess my everlasting need of God, the need of forgiveness for our selfishness and greed, the need of new life for empty souls, the need of love for hearts grown cold.